This is, as you can see from the title slide, the 14th class that we've had in the series on miracles. We've looked at the Old Testament, some 50 miracles that took place there. Since we have a couple of visitors this morning, I just wanted to say that we've discovered a couple of things about miracles, though, that are not very commonly believed. One of which is that they have an extremely specific purpose. That purpose is to identify, to confirm a particular individual as a prophet, as a representative, as a spokesperson for God. The miracles are not just acts of kindness so that people might have relief from physical problems. If that were the case, why are there so many people with physical problems, you know, today, as well as back in the days when we had those miracles? They are, for the purpose, they are called repeatedly signs of pointing at God, directing our minds and our thoughts toward God. We saw then, secondly, that they're, you know, surprisingly rare. There are only 50 in all the hundreds of years of the Old Testament. They are not frequent because they're not needed constantly or frequently to fulfill the purpose we've just been talking about. So we looked at clusters of miracles in the Old Testament times, and we're seeing what is the most abundant period of miracle working in all of world history, which is the time of Christ, particularly, and then the apostles. So we have seen the purpose, we've seen the relative rarity, we have seen that as we come to the New Testament, no miracles have been worked at all for several hundred years, not since the time of Daniel in the 500s. Do you have miraculous things taking place? And then we come to Jesus and there's this explosion, which we've been studying now for several weeks. So we've come now to Luke. The events that we're about to be studying this morning are found, almost all of them, in three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Since miracles are so rare in the Gospel of John, we've already had a whole class that was just on John's miracles. We put them in a separate category. Very few in the Gospel of John, but many in the three Gospels. Each has particular miracles that the others don't tell us about, but for whatever purposes the Holy Spirit has, and I'm not sure I can tell you what they are at all, he felt that these miracles are either of such a nature or so important or had such great consequences or something that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the three that focus more on miracles, will all tell us about these events. So, I've picked only the Gospel of Luke this morning to make it easier for you. They're collected right here in this 8th chapter. So, we'll just stay in Luke 8, but just be aware, you can find little bits and pieces of additional information that Matthew or Mark may have mentioned that's not found in this particular text. But we're all familiar with these events anyway. You know, who does not know about Luke chapter 8 and verses 22 through 25? It came about on one of these days that he and his disciples got into a boat, and he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake." What lake is that? Sea of Galilee. How long is the Sea of Galilee? In very rough terms, it rises and falls. It's at an extreme low ebb right now. They've been suffering a drought for a long time. But how long is it roughly? What's the figure we've been using? 13 miles. 13 miles. And then it's about 7 wide at its widest point. So it has a pretty flat northern shore. It then kind of shoulders out, and then it comes much more narrowly to a point at the bottom there. So 13 miles long, as much as 7 wide. When they set out here then to cross the lake, it's no easy task. You got sails and all their boats, but if there is no wind to start, then what do? You know, that's what paddles were made for. And unless you're going to take a rope in your mouth and try to swim and tow the boat at the same time, you know, it's really the only way to move the thing. And it's not real fast. It takes a lot of effort. They'll have a lot of guys in the boat. So depending on the size of their boat, which we can't know, there might be room and paddles for every single one of them to get going, and then, you know, you could pick up a pretty good clip. But if you're going to cross this lake, even if you've started in Capernaum, which is pretty well dead center at the top, and you're only going to cross over half, you know, we're just going to go 3 or 4 miles, that's still a pretty serious journey. So in the process of this, in Acts chapter 8, in verse 22, they launched out. And in verse 23, as they were sailing along, he, and that's Jesus, of course, fell asleep. Which suggests, first, the work's been hard. It always has been for him. Seldom time enough to even pray. And so he just collapses, I presume, falls asleep. And a fierce gale of wind descended upon the lake, and they began to be swamped and to be in danger. Now, this wind is so notorious that it has a name over there. It's called a sirocco. It's an S-C-I-R, maybe two R's, O-C-O, sirocco. They are really dangerous. And the reason they exist is because the Sea of Galilee on its eastern shores has a low plateau. It's not a real high elevation at all. And then you just kind of plateau out, and it's Syria for an awful long ways. So if you've ever looked at a map, we've got all the events going on in the Middle East these days, you know, Syria is just huge, and it's desert. So it's also very flat for long distances, so that these winds can be ferocious as they develop in the east, and then will very unexpectedly, very suddenly, come sweeping in to Galilee, and they just descend that lake, and in the process can chew it up as badly or worse than you see in this particular painting. It's Rembrandt, I think, on the one that I've got right here. So very, very dangerous. These are seasoned fishermen. They know what this lake is about. They know they're in serious trouble right here, and many a sailor, many a fisherman, you know, have lost their lives in the process of these storms, which just are surprisingly sudden and violent. So in verse 23, they're sailing along, he fell asleep, a fierce gale of wind, so apparently even worse than the normal ones, descended upon the lake. They began to be swamped and to be in danger. So seasoned fishermen, handlers of such a craft, you know, are sinking. In 24, they came to him and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And of course, the other writers, you know, suggesting a little bit of criticism. Don't you care about that? But he, being aroused, rebuked the wind and the surging waves. Peace be still. They stopped. It became calm instantaneously. Now, brethren, as sudden as the wind is, you at least have a tiny little bit of a warning because you can see the dust coming. I got caught in a sirocco in 2011. I was not on the lake, but I was on the North Shore. I was walking in an easterly direction, doing a leg of about 7 or 8 miles on a 5-day hike from Nazareth up to the North Shore, where the Jordan dumps into the Sea of Galilee. When this wind hit, it was so hot and must have been running 40 miles an hour or more, I found myself forced to pull my hat down over my face. I tried to use it like a shield so I'd get my head in behind it, and then quite literally I had to lean into this wind to try to just gain any ground against it. It's not just that it's sudden and fast. It's also that these winds are so very dry. This air, after coming across Syria that way, dehydrates you in just minutes. It's unbelievable. And so finally, I had to leave the trail. It's a long story, but the trail's designed, you know, to take you off the beaten paths and away from the highways and everything. And I just had to leave it and stop pretending that I was living in 2,000 years ago and walking with the Lord, you know, on this trail. And I staggered into a gas station and got myself a couple of liters of fruit juices to try and replenish myself. I was getting in serious trouble. I was carrying a 3-liter Camelback, and I drank through that in no time at all. And finally, just had to give up. It goes, seek hydration, you know, here. So it carries with it. Imagine the best, I think, the idea is talcum powder. The air is filled with this microscopically fine dust. So every breath just coats your lungs with this dust, sears them with the heat, exhausts you if you're trying to walk a row against it, and turns the Sea of Galilee into a death trap. So they're wondering, how could you sleep through this? You know, how could you be unconcerned? So then in verse 24, he just says, be still. Apparently, faster than the wind descended, where at least you can see it coming at 40 miles an hour, everything just goes to perfect tranquility. Now, they've spent their whole lives on this lake, all these men. They've lived in Galilee. They're identified in the book of Acts. Every one of the apostles is a Galilean. That lake is the center of Galilee. That lake is their water source. It's their food source. These men are fishermen, most of them. They know this lake. So for them especially, it is awesome. In 25, he said to them, where's your faith? And they were fearful and amazed, saying to one another, who then is this that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him? Now, brethren, at this point, we've already been through some 20 miracles. These apostles have witnessed these 20 miracles and many more. Time and again, we've had these cover expressions that say he did many other miracles. So we get just highlights in the 45 that are in the New Testament, or in the Gospels, rather. So we're just getting highlights. These men have seen a lot of miracles. They're all impressive. What did this one do to them? Nathanael declared that Jesus was the Son of God and King of Israel with the first miracle he ever experienced. Jesus being able to tell him what he was doing under the fig tree. You know? And so he just immediately responded, Son of God, King of Israel. Right? But this is in their, no pun intended, wheelhouse. Okay? No steamer expression, no paddle wheelers and that. These are boaters. So when you really know your business, this is what you do. And it's impossible. Then it's impressive for these men. So he spares their lives. He teaches them this lesson. They will now continue processing the data. Who is this? He's even greater than we thought he was when he was healing every disease that there is. This is something. So, any comment or question on Luke? We're all familiar with it. See the power over, you know, nature and all of that. It's pretty straightforward. Any questions? Okay, on the next one, we're going to just keep reading verses 26 through 39. What you have on the screen there is a photograph I just grabbed off the internet. But this photo, I didn't take myself, was snapped in Israel. These are wild pigs in Israel. So, you know, there's different species of pigs and all of that. And to be frank, they do today have the little pigskin, smooth, you know, piggy that we're all so familiar with. But I chose rather to put these up because I do not know, we can't know, you know, what kind of pig it was that we're about to have this long story about. So I just leave that up for you here because at least it's a strong possibility that the pigs that you may have always envisioned as being cute with little curlicue tails, you know, it's not the case at all. These things are really ugly. Okay. And they're not pink at all. And they're hairy. And they have little tusks and all that. But, you know, that is the natural pig, the wild pig that lives in the area there. So, as you can see, 26 or 39, it's a long story. So let's go ahead and take this event on then. And note that they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. So apparently the stilling of the storm takes place as they're sailing east and perhaps a little tiny bit south to get over on the eastern shore, which is the area of the Decapolis. What does Decapolis mean? It means 10 cities. Apollos is a city. It was a region of 10 significant cities that the Romans had designated as the Decapolis. It has many Jews living over there. It has in the past been tribal territories for tribes of Israel back, you know, in the Old Testament times. But it's a Roman area now, the Decapolis, and it is, therefore, it is an area that's more arid, it's more dry because it is on the Syrian side over there. It's very, very hilly, and it is particularly steep all along the shoreline that's coming down to the Sea of Galilee. So they now, in verse 26, come to this country of the Gerasenes opposite Galilee. Well, it just means the bulk of the Galilean region, the land region, is on the western shores. Then this is on the other shore of the Sea of Galilee. 27. When he had come out onto the land, he was met by a certain man from the city who was possessed with demons, no plural, and who had not put on any clothing for a long time. So the body has been suffering the ravages of weather, and was not living in a house, but in the tombs. So you're well aware this is abhorrent to the Jews. It is unclean. It's a defilement. But he's also a naked man who is must have been looking a whole lot like Nebuchadnezzar did. We just studied Daniel here a little while ago. And so here's a man living more like these animals than he is living like a human being. And so in verse 28, seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell before him and said in a loud voice, "What do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" That is apparently privileged information. He didn't recognize him from personal association or an introduction. This is apparently the demon speaking, because especially of the last short sentence at the end of verse 28. "I beg you, do not torment me." So, what do I have to do with you? He identifies Jesus by name, Son of the Most High God. "Don't torment me." 29. "For he had been commanding the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had seized him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard, and yet he would burst his fetters and be driven by the demon into the desert." Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion, for many demons had entered him, and they were entreating him not to command them to depart into the abyss." Wouldn't you like to know more about that? So would I. Wouldn't you like to know in the other passages about the waterless places that the demons will have to go where they can find no rest? What about that? We don't know. Deuteronomy 29:29. "The secret things belong to God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children." If we needed to know, we'd be told. They may have known back then, because it was a time when demon possession was taking place. We live 2,000 years after the end of demon possession. Satan fell like lightning out of heaven. He has lost much of his power. His ability to possess someone has ended. And as I pointed out a couple of times, we do have some visitors. Zechariah's last three chapters, the book of Zechariah, 12, 13, 14, fascinating material. It identifies, beyond all conceivable doubt, the time of Jesus and references his crucifixion and a fountain for sin, what's going to take place, you know, in the forgiveness of sins because of that sacrifice. It also says that prophecy and demons will go out of the land when Jesus comes. Jesus came, he said to the apostles, I have a lot more to tell you, but you know, I've got to leave. So I'm going to send the Holy Spirit. He'll guide you into all the truth. He'll bring to your remembrance everything I said to you. So now, they have, for a very brief period of time, they have miraculous powers, as Jesus did, while the Holy Spirit is revealing to them what will become the rest of our New Testament. Okay, so new information being written down. They needed the signs to prove that they were representatives of God, just like Jesus needed them. They needed the signs to demonstrate that this new information, which will be compiled into the New Testament, is from God and not from man. So, they lived in an era where miracles were taking place, and therefore in an era when demon possession was taking place. But Zechariah says that as a result of Christ coming on the cross and dying for our sins, you will see the end of prophesying, because the New Testament will be completed. There won't be any more prophets to point out and say, see, new revelation from God. And demons will also pass out of the land. That's obvious. If the miracles are going to cease, as 1 Corinthians 13 says they will, then we're left with demon possession and no way, you know, to help these poor people and to banish these demons. So that's another study we'll come to in detail at the end of this series. For now, just know, if we still have demon possession today, and if we still have prophets today, then according to Zechariah, Jesus is not the Son of God. He is not the King of Israel. His death on the cross has nothing to do with the forgiveness of sins. And we're still waiting for the Messiah. Because Zechariah made it abundantly plain that the part of the proofs, the evidence that we have the Messiah, is that demon possession and prophesying will cease. I believe both ended by 70 A.D. Some think maybe another 30 years, but either way, haven't been any miracles, hasn't been any demon possession since either 70 or 100 A.D. But they sure had it now. So Jesus is going to deal with this. They had treated him, you know, don't send us into this abyss. I don't know anything more about that. They did. The people of the time maybe did. Do I need to know? No. Well, there isn't any demon possession anyway anymore, so why would I need to know? 32. There was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain. Then the demons entreated him to permit them to enter the swine. And he gave them permission. Wouldn't you like to know more about that? Why did he do that? And we just don't know, brethren, because it doesn't tell us. It's a secret thing. We can see the results. I'll read it in a minute. We can, you know, compute that likely this event, because of what we'll read about its consequences, might explain the decision not to just banish the demons to the abyss, which is the thing they apparently deserved, feared, didn't want. Why didn't he just do it anyway? Why would Jesus acquiesce to the commands of demons? And then, why this event with the swine? He gives them permission. Does Jesus not know what he'll do with the swine? Why did the swine react like this? Why would the demons drive the swine to do this? There are so many questions. Ain't it great? Brethren, what is faith all about anyway? Faith is not what you do in the absence of evidence. We have faith because of overwhelming evidence. But faith is what sometimes you just have to trust God that it's okay for you to not know something that He's decided you're not going to know. So He didn't tell us the answer to these questions. I can't know the answer until He does. I don't need to know then. We'll do the best we can to try to, you know, derive some kind of suspicion, but we're not going to know. But it happens in 33, the demons came out from the man and entered the swine. The herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, their entire livelihood, of course, They ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country. People went out to see what had happened. They came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting down at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. So apparently, you know, this event transpires over the course maybe, you know, of even several hours. As we've got a lot going on, they have to run back to town. This man, we've got to find some clothing for him. You know, so we read it as if it's all just boom, boom, boom. But there's some time going on, and steep place, you know, probably not the city right there, be it less, you know, a difficult place to live. So now they're running around, and we just have some time passing. But the end result is it scares them to death at the end of verse 35. And for a wide variety of reasons. We've seen people frightened before because of such power. When you're in the presence of something that you know is vastly powerful, even if it's done good things, power itself is just plain dangerous. My dad spent 35 years, I think it was, working for Mobil Oil in the Torrance Refinery, Torrance, California, L.A. area. And they had a program when I was much younger. Any employee who had kids, boys or girls, who were in school, college-age kids, and you're in school, is automatically given a summer job with Mobil if you want it. So you can come and work in the plant, guaranteed. However many there are, if we got an employee with college-age kids, they want to work here, we're going to hire them. So for two summers, I worked in a Mobil Oil refinery. I will never forget the day that I'm in my early 20s and I'm sweeping, which is, as you can imagine, about the only job they had for us. They guaranteed we could work, and all we did was, you know, sweep pavement. And I'm out in the midst of this huge, I don't know how many acres it was, of all these tanks and various kinds of mechanical devices, and they're overwhelmingly loud. So my dad told me right off the bat, make sure you put those earplugs in before you get out of the car. Don't take them out till you get at, you know, back in that car. If you're on plant grounds, you wear, you know, your earplugs, because it will surely just destroy your vision. Your hearing. I have vision on my mind now for months. You know, it'll destroy your hearing. So I'm there, you know, wearing my earplugs, and I'm sweeping one day, and all of a sudden, you know, that typical warning horn goes off. So, you know, what's that? And I turn and I look, and every employee in the place is running as fast as he can. I knew two things. I knew I needed to run, and I knew where to run. How did I know where? Because I had to catch those guys. Okay, wherever they're going, that's where I'm going. Well, they had a major malfunction of some kind. They understood the power, didn't they? But I didn't. Horn goes off, and I just stand there in curiosity. Well, what does that mean? What should I do? They knew, because they understood the power that was in play here. So these apostles, they're walking next to a refinery all day long. You know, they're seeing this power. And now all these people are seeing this power. And now they're seeing the power over not even a single demon, but many demons. And now they're seeing the destruction of an entire herd of income-producing animals for some, you know, poor group of farmers. So they became frightened. I like refineries. They make gasoline. That's a good thing. But if that power should ever be turned against you, you know you're in trouble. So in verse 36, those who had seen it reported to them how the man who was demon-possessed had been made well. All the people of the country, the Gerasenes and the surrounding district asked him to what? Go away. Please. You've cost us what was probably the equivalent of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah, its entire herd has gone off the cliff. You now have maybe upset the whole balance of our economy over here. I don't know what this man represented. Did you know in the entire country of Israel right now, there's only 20 pig farms at all? So who knows how, you know, dependent the Gentiles of the Decapolis, these Roman citizens, were upon that particular income. Now, this is not a Jew. Would the Jews be involved in pig farming? No. We're in the country of the Gerasenes, not the Jews. So it's just a huge event. The people of the country, the Gerasenes, the surrounding district, asked him to depart from them, for they were gripped with fear. And what does he do? He says, okay. And he got in his boat and took off again. All right. So what do we learn? How many times does Mark, the Gospel of Mark, tell us about Jesus casting out a demon? 13 times. Mark's gospel is the one that features demons more than the others. Only 16 chapters, 13 demon references. Okay? But in this one, we get our fullest account. We get conversation, information that puzzles us about the abyss. We get, you know, a man is possessed not by one demon, but by many. We have the herd of swine. All these unanswered questions. What happened in the land of the Gerasenes? Did anybody not know that an awesome power had walked among them? It scared them to death. That power was so vast. So they asked Jesus to leave. Does that mean their curiosity will end and they'll never utter the name Jesus or wonder about him again? No. If anything ever pointed at Jesus as the Son of God, King of Israel, this event would be chief among them. How many people it impacts, how violent it is, the death, you know, the splash off the cliff, you know, all the rest of that. Now, just for fun, and I really hope this works, I want everybody to look at the screen here. As you know, I went to Israel just last June. Emma Vermette and Susan Dahl were also a part of that trip. One morning, I left everybody because I just love the country and I like to explore anyway. At 3:30 in the morning, I got up and I ran north a two-hour drive, got in my car, two-hour drive, and for Mike Moody's sake, I was trying to get up to the top of Mount Hermon, which is a 9,000-foot mountain, you know, in Israel. I want to see how high I could get. It's in the north, and it looks south. So I drove for 2 hours. I got there. I got to watch a sunrise over Syria, but I didn't make the full 9,000 feet. I was probably about 5 or 6, but I could see in Syria, and I watched the sunrise over Syria. I then came back down off the mountain, and I was on the eastern side of Israel and had come down into the plateau lands that is magnificent cattle grazing land. There were cattle all over the hills, the cattle of 1,000 hills. You know, we're out there. There was also this. I snapped that picture as I was approaching, you know, that corner. I was slowing down anyway. And then to my surprise, this happened. Do you see how fast they are? Imagine 500, 1,000. How many were in this herd? It would have been thunderous. And in this territory, the dust. Okay? And then off the cliff, at downhill on a steep grade, animals that can really move. It would have been such a violent and amazing thing to watch. And then my whole business is gone. So these are the wild pigs of Israel. I just happened to be there at the right moment. But doesn't it just kind of bring things into a sharper focus now? What an event. I probably would have asked Jesus to leave too. Not sure I'm ready for this. You go away. Let me think about it for a while. Let's turn now to Luke chapter 8, verses 43 through 48. In 43, a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years, so she's bleeding, could not be healed by anyone. There's no way to stop this awful bloody wound. Came up behind him, touched the fringe of his cloak, and immediately her hemorrhage stopped. She's had blood just gushing out of her for who knows how long, and it just like the wind and the waves stopped. She knew she was healed. She could see she was healed. And all she had done was touch the fringe of his cloak. Jesus said, "Who's the one who touched me?" And while they were all denying it, Peter said, "Master, the multitudes are crowding and pressing upon you." But Jesus said, "Someone did touch me, for I was aware that power had gone out of me." And when the woman saw that she had not escaped notice, she came trembling and fell down before him and declared in the presence of all the people the reason why she touched him and how she'd been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." Now, the range of activities surrounding miracles is really curious. And so, in this case, you know, Jesus starts off, he's there. He'll see someone and say they're healed. He'll touch someone and say they're healed. He'll spit and make mud and put it in their eyes and tell them to go wash and they will be healed. So he's there, he's not there, he performs these separate actions. This is the one time where we discover something about Jesus that once again provokes more questions than answers. It's like he was just a walking power plant in this particular occasion, isn't it? And yet, Jesus wants to make a special point. Is it just that he glows in the dark and emanates this power and all you got to do is touch him? Well, that's what happened. But is it only that? Why does he say, "I want to know who did it? I want to know who you are. I want all these people to know." And what do we learn? What do we now know? He attributed it, yes, power went out from me. But what did he say to her? "Your faith. Your faith." So there is a tie. There is a link. And we'll see it again in just a minute. The miracles are designed to produce faith that is true. Is it the only way that faith can be produced? Faith comes by hearing and hearing by the Word of God. It's not the only source of faith, but it does produce faith, confidence, trust in the individual. It's a sign. That's what it's supposed to do. She had seen enough, heard enough to come to believe in him. It is the faith that she had gotten from evidence that brought her to him, believing, "If I can just get there, he can heal me. I believe this." So she was granted her desire. That is not to say that there are still miracles going on today. All the Pentecostal churches are practicing them. And every time they fail, which is every time, and you can see that they fail because they didn't send you home to get well over the next few weeks, they fail. And you see it. What is their one reason every time? It's your fault because you don't have enough faith. And they'll point at this passage. Okay? They fail to see that faith is what Jesus is trying to produce, and he is working miracles, in this case, in response to her faith, but then he forces her to go public, so what happens to everybody else's? A new kind of a type of miracle that we see right here. So, the faith may precede or follow the miracle. The power is not dependent on the faith. So, have your faith before, find your faith after. The power is the same. Let nobody say there are still miracles today, because that isn't true. Scripture teaches not. But also, you know, when you meet your friends, all these various people are so desperate and they're suffering, you know, and they're ready to resort to this kind of thing, they're going to be disappointed. You know, help them to understand that it is just the worst kind of obscenity for these people to claim these fake things to begin with and then to blame it on you when they can't succeed. You know, I've seen people crushed by this, And I've gotten to be pretty passionate about it. So here's this woman. Off she goes. Point is, believe in Jesus. Now, we got to back up a little bit because the prelude actually precedes her healing. But in 40 through 42, as Jesus returned, the multitude welcomed him. They'd all been waiting for him. Behold, there came a man named Jairus. He's an official of the synagogue. He fell at Jesus' feet, began to entreat him, come to his house. He had an only daughter, about 12 years old. She was dying. But as he went, the multitude were pressing against him. Now we read about the woman pressing up against him. So it was hard to walk because of the crowd. But Jairus is desperate. His daughter's at death's door. He's come to Jesus. He's there at his shoulder. He's staying with Jesus, trying to save his daughter. Now you got to skip to 49 after this woman. While he was still speaking, someone came from the house, the synagogue official, saying, "Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." But when Jesus heard, he answered him, "Do not be afraid. Only believe. She shall be made well." And when he had come to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the girl's father and mother. I love this illustration right here. It's one of the few that actually gets it right. So got at least the right number of people in the room. Now, they were all weeping and lamenting for her, but he said, "Stop weeping. She has not died, but is asleep." Now, I've warned you, we're hurrying, but I know these things. These are miracles that we've all studied many, many times. Is she dead or not? She's dead. Is she just sleeping like you and I did last night? No, she's dead. Why would Jesus say this? Two reasons. One is to make sure they understand that she really is dead. They're going to argue with him about this. They know dead when they see it. And so, if you say she's not, then confirmation takes place. Jesus is setting the stage for what is about to take place. But secondly, because he can raise people from the dead, then is it going to kind of be like going to sleep last night? She's waking up, isn't she? Yeah, she is. So, in verse 53, they began laughing at him, knowing she had died. He, however, took her by the hand and called, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned. She rose immediately. He gave orders for something to be given her to eat. Her parents were amazed, but he instructed them what? Don't tell anybody. And we've explored this before as well. Some people are told, don't you tell a soul. Now, we're going to wrap up here with Matthew chapter 9. So come please to Matthew chapter 9. We've got just a couple of quick cleanup verses, if you will. So Jesus now, he's raised from the dead. He's stilled a storm. He's healed every kind of sick. He's been there. He's not been there. He's used kind of a tool like spit and mud and have the man go somewhere and wash. You know, he's had power go out when he had said a thing or introduced himself or talked to anybody. He's done everything. Now in 9:27 through 31 of Matthew, 9:27. Jesus passed on from there. Two blind men followed him, crying out, saying, "Have mercy on us, son of David." After he'd come into the house, the blind men came up to him, and Jesus said to them, "Do you believe I'm able to do this?" They said, "Yes, Lord." He touched their eyes, saying, "Be it done to you according to your faith." Their eyes were opened. Jesus sternly warned them, "See, let no one know." But they went out and spread the news about him in all that land. We have seen that before as well. So that's why I say these are kind of repetitious. They're the same thing in a different area. So we'll just keep reading. 9:32. As they were going out, behold, a dumb man, demon-possessed, was brought to him. And after the demon was cast out, the dumb man spoke. And the multitudes marveled, saying, "He cast out demons by the ruler of the demons." Have we had this before? Same thing. Here we go again. Jesus was going about all the cities and the villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Don't you wish you could have been there? Everywhere this man goes, thousands gather around him. He can hardly walk through the crowd. If you just want to be healed and to touch the outer
hem of his garment, you'll be healed. I can call you back from the dead. I can still a storm. I can walk on water. You name it, I can do it. And you demons, beware. Bodies floating on the Sea of Galilee. Is there anybody in Israel who does not know who Jesus is? Class dismissed.